Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Hello and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. Well, it's safe to say Democrats are going through something of an identity crisis at the moment. There's no clear leaders, no driving issues, no real power in Washington. And it makes the current government shutdown an interesting test case for Democratic leaders like Chuck Schumer over what they think their voters want and how best to fight Donald Trump. My guest today, Democratic strategist Liz Smith, has not minced words when it comes to perceptions of her party. She told the New York Times that the Democratic brand was, quote, in the toilet, and recently called for Democrats to, quote, burn the party establishment down. Smith, however, is not some upstart campaign disruptor. She's a veteran of 20 political campaigns, most recently as a senior advisor to Pete Buttigieg's 2020 presidential campaign. This makes her critique of the party and the work she's doing this cycle to try and fix it worth understanding and exploring more deeply. We recorded this conversation on Wednesday, October 7th. Liz Smith, hello. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yes, thanks for having me, Amy.
I've been really looking forward to this for quite some time because you have been involved in Democratic politics for quite some time. We're not going to age you or me in this, but you've been around with all kinds of candidates and all kinds of different political environments. And I've been reading and watching you since the 2024 election talk about your frustration with the sort of current Democratic Party brand and the regime. I think it was on Bulwark podcast the other day where you said something like, we need to burn the establishment down. So let's start with the first most timely question, which is, given the frustration you have with Democratic Party leadership, how well do you think they're doing in the shutdown fight?
I think that they're doing a lot better than they have been doing. And I've been pretty impressed by the message discipline, right?
Were you surprised by it? By the discipline, that is.
A little bit, maybe. A little bit. Because Democrats tend to just like chase every rabbit down every hole, right? And I was afraid that you were going to have Democrats saying, oh, this is about rule of law or this or that. But Democrats have done a really good job of keeping this on healthcare, which I think is the message and the message that we need to win this fight. But, you know, that being said, Amy, I don't want to date us, but like, I think I first met you 16 years ago, sitting across the table during Terry McAuliffe's first run for governor in Virginia.
Yes.
And in between now and then, think about how many times and how many minutes of our life, hours of our life, we've spent talking about shutdowns. And like, can you really remember any of them mattering that much? So, but I do think they're doing better. I think really keeping the focus here on healthcare has been really smart. And the more we can make it about healthcare, about real people's lives, about how people's premiums would double if the Republicans don't, negotiate on this, then, and less about like Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries and the personalities in Washington, I think the better.
Right. So as you said, people don't remember this. Right. The 2026 midterms are not going to be defined by the government shutdown, just like they weren't in 2014 or 2019, back to all of our different iterations of these shutdowns. So what comes of this, right? Like if indeed this was an opportunity for Democratic leadership to show the base that they're serious about fighting Trump,
is this enough? Is this going to make people say, well, you know what? Maybe we should stick with the Democratic leadership we have and we shouldn't burn the establishment down.
Well, I think it will at least, you know, save Schumer's hide through the midterms, right? Because we saw after that, the last CR, whenever that was, last in April.
I know. It feels like that was 25 years ago.
I mean, the anger at Chuck Schumer from the Democratic base was crazy. And it's still there. I was talking to a Democratic Party chair the other day, and I'm going to give a speech on Friday to these Democrats in Illinois. I was like, are there any names I maybe shouldn't mention? And he was like, any Democratic names? They were okay with AOC, even though it's a moderate county. Okay with Zoran Mondani. They were like, maybe I wouldn't mention Chuck Schumer. So that sort of tells you the level of anger there. Mm. But what I think an effective thing here does is, one, it shows the base, okay, we have a spine, we're willing to stand up, we're willing to fight, we're willing to draw the line on things really essential like healthcare. I think it signals to swing voters and to people who, you know, lives really would be affected by this, that like we are on their side and we're fighting for something that is going to make a tangible economic benefit in their life. And that's important because one thing we saw after the 2024 election is that a lot of people thought that we don't care about their economic well-being, that we care more about fighting for this discrete group here or this discrete group here, but not like you or your economic well-being. And so this, I think, directly counters that perception of Democrats. And for the leadership, I think that's it saves them, you know, through the midterms, and then we can have that discussion.
Right. Well, one of the people that's having that discussion is Mallory McMorrow, is running in Michigan. I know you're working with her and her campaign running for the Senate there. She's one of a number of Senate candidates who are saying, you know what, if I get into the Senate, I'm going to vote for somebody else for leadership. She's not the only one who's saying that. But it feels like, and tell me if we're stretching this analogy a little bit too far, but it feels like Democrats are in a sort of Tea Party moment here, frustrated with the establishment, frustrated with the leadership, feeling like we need outsiders to come in and kind of shake things up. Is that a fair way to think about this? Or how do you describe this moment that Democrats are in?
Yeah, when we first saw the polling after that bungled CR, is it the CR? I'm a campaign person. I
don't know. We don't do legislating. We do campaigns, Liz. Let's just
thank God. Okay? That whole thing back in April, right? That whole thing back in April. When we saw the polling, someone turned to me and was like, holy, can we cuss on this? Can I say?
You can. You can say whatever you want.
Said, holy shit, this is like our Tea Party moment. And it does feel that way in terms of like the vibes, but it's a little bit different. Yeah. So I think the Tea Party moment in 2010, really, it was one, yes, it was anti-establishment. It was anti the Washington deal makers, like that Indiana senator who lost to Murdoch in the primary. But it was also very ideological. And like the Republicans wanted more to get into these culture wars. They wanted culture warriors. They wanted to go more to the right than the Republican establishment was. And that's why in 2012, when you saw Mitt Romney run again, you saw a very different version of Mitt Romney from 4 years prior. With Democrats, yes, there is that anger at the establishment, that they think that they are weak and spineless, just as Republicans did back then with their leadership. But it's, I think, a little bit less ideological. We're not saying go so far to the left. It's more like pass the torch. It's time for new leaders. Like, we cannot have 80-year-olds being our presidential nominee, leading us at all these different levels, saying, wait your turn, whether it's like, you know, Joe Biden running for president or Chuck Schumer as leader, or, you know, Ed Markey running in Massachusetts or whatever it is. You know, it's time to pass the torch to a new generation. And I think that's what you're seeing bubble up, whether it's with, you know, someone like Mallory McMorrow in Michigan, Graham Plattner in Maine, two of the candidates who have called on this, is that they're channeling the very real feeling that they have and that the base has, that like following the gerontocracy off the cliff has been a very, very bad thing for Democrats, and that it is time for a new generation of leaders to stand up, new generation of leaders who have the fire in their belly, who feel these issues viscerally, right? Like, you understand things like how hard it is to afford to buy a house or how expensive childcare is. If you have actually had to do those things in the last few years.
That's 20 years.
And not like 40
yes,
years.
And not like, right? Right.
That's
right.
The problem. And you're going to understand like social media more and how to communicate more if yeah. you actually use these things. And, you know, that's a big gap too, is that like a lot of these leaders just don't know how to compete in today's media and information atmosphere.
Yeah. Though it's interesting, and you're seeing this in Michigan too, is it feels like ideologically, some of them are going to be more to the left, whether that's Mamdani, Plattner, and in Michigan, you have El-Said, all of whom are Bernie AOC types, and they've been in, many of them been endorsed by Bernie Sanders. Some of the frustration that you hear from Democrats, one is not fighting hard enough. And then there's this whole fight now in the Democratic sort of think tank world of, well, we've been pushed, Democrats will say, we've been pushed too far to the left on cultural and social issues and some of the stuff, Green New Deal, et cetera, by
right.
Bernie Sanders et al. And that's what's alienated us from regular working people. So can you kind of work through for me, like how you're seeing mm-hmm. all of these different cross currents coming together that we're going to end up in front of voters in a year from now?
Well, I think there's no doubt that this sort of litmus test hysteria that took over the Democratic Party, you know, I think really from 2017 on and peaked probably 2020,
yeah.
that did some long-term damage to the Democratic brand and certainly came back to haunt Kamala Harris in 2020 with the they, them ads when, you know, ACLU was asking candidates to commit to free gender assignment surgery for inmates, like something that doesn't even really happen, you know? But why? Just to exert power and get people to adopt the most maximalist positions. So I think forcing candidates to adopt the most maximalist positions, whether it's on climate, choice, guns, was a disaster. And if we want to be a Big Tent party, we want to build a majority, we want to build a durable majority, we have to understand that there's no one way to be a Democrat and that purity tests are really, really destructive and that, you know, it's fine to have Zohran Mamdani in New York. You know, I'm a Zohran Mamdani voter, as unbelievable as that might sound. But we also need to have a Joe Manchin in West Virginia. We need to have a Jamie Ager, you know, a candidate who's running down in North Carolina and give them the space to run without making them adopt positions that will make it impossible for them to win in these areas. Because you know what? A Democrat who agrees with us on 7 out of 10 issues is a hell of a lot better than a Republican who agrees with us on 0 out of 10 issues.
Yeah, that's what seems to be somewhat different here too from the Tea Party movement. And I noticed you tweeted about this the other day, is somebody like Jared Golden in Maine, who is a conservative and he goes against the Democratic leadership on a lot of things, which you have to do when you're in the most Republican district held by a Democrat in the entire country. He is getting challenged from the left. That didn't happen as much to Democrats like Joe Manchin or Heidi, go back, Joe Donnelly. They weren't getting attacked from the left as much. Do you think that that's what we're going to see now of the few sort of folks who are left in those positions, that they are going to have to hit some purity test? Or
no, I actually take the opposite view.
Okay.
After 2018, we saw a lot of this, right? I mean, God, how many times did they try to take out Henry Cuellar in Texas,
yeah.
right? It felt like
yeah.
I just saw AOC spending like half her time down there. You know, Lacey Clay in St. Louis was primaried from the left. And now this cycle, all we're really seeing is Jared Golden, but the response to it has been fascinating. First of all, I mean, don't even get me started. I could go on forever about how dumb that primary challenge is, but you're not like seeing a cavalry ride in behind Matt Dunlap, right?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Like in the way that you did with these other primary challenges. And in fact, there's been much more backlash to it than there has been support, even online, which I don't really like look online to get voter sentiment. I do look online to get lefty sentiment. And you see people being like, God, I fucking hate Jared Golden, but We should not be primarying him. He's the top overperformer.
He's the only person who can win this district. Right.
He's the only person who can win this district. And, you know, he is, yeah, he's, I would quibble with calling him conservative. I think he calls himself like a progressive conservative or something like that. He's definitely a heterodox guy. In some ways, you know, he's a populist. And if anything, I think we need more Jared Goldens in our party. People who are younger, people who are rooted in their district, people who are very authentic. That guy is very authentic as they come. And if we want to build a majority party, you know, a group I'm advising is called Majority Democrats. And full disclosure, Jared Golden is one of them. And the name is based on the idea that if we want to have a majority party, we need to like think like one and build one. And that includes supporting people like Jared Golden. And if we want to build a durable majority in the House, we're going to have to recruit candidates who are, frankly, to the right of Jared Golden.
A quick break. We'll be back with Liz Smith. If you want to stay up to date on all redistricting news, check out our new redistricting tracker. We'll be continually updating it as we get news of midterm redistricting in states. The CPR redistricting tracker is only available to Cook Political Report subscribers, so consider subscribing today. Go to www.cookpolitical.com/subscriber. Use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. The offer is available only to new subscribers.
When you think about some of these candidates and what they will be like when they come, if a Marilyn McMorrow, Graham Plattner were to win and come to the United States Senate, how do you think they will be different? You know, they want to shake up the establishment. What do you think that looks like? If you have four, it's one thing to have one of them, but if you get three or four of them this cycle, what does that do?
I think there are people who are going to be more willing to challenge their party and speak out against their party when they think that leadership isn't delivering. And that's a big change from right now, because I don't know about you. I don't know if you talk to Democratic senators behind the scenes after that CR debacle or government funding debacle, whatever you want to call it. But they were, to a person, pretty pissed at Chuck Schumer, but you didn't see them out there publicly saying it. You saw some blind quotes here or there. Michael Bennett, I think, probably is the only one I can think of who really spoke out. But these leaders, you know, whether it's a Mallory McMorrow, Graham Plattner, even like a James Tallarico, who also is, you know, someone who I've advised and and is a part of Majority Democrats. I think these are people who will be willing to go out there and like say, this isn't it. We need to fight. We need to fight harder. But another thing too, and this is more on the tactical side, is that they're gonna breathe some fresh air into the U.S. Senate and really bring a new communication style, which I think has been lacking in the U.S. Senate. I know they're trying, but it's really, really hard for them to break through. And I think what we've seen with Graham Plattner, with James Tallarico, with Mallory McMorrow, is that these are people who can really break through the noise. And even on stuff like cost of living, like Mallory had an ad on the Red Zone, a Red Zone ad, how Red Zone's now doing commercials, and talked about all the ways that Football Sunday has become much more expensive for people. And, you know, she's not like yelling about democracy, yelling about Trump being a fascist, just talking about cost of living stuff. And that was able to go mega viral because it was, one, you know that that's a woman who's watching football on Sundays. But two, you know, she just did it in a direct and fresh way a lot of our current leaders can't.
Thinking now past the midterms and into 2028, you've worked, obviously, with presidential candidates, Pete Buttigieg being the most recent, who's obviously still in the mix for this. But I want to sort of step back a moment and talk a little bit about, is the challenge that Democrats are facing right now as much a messenger problem as it is a message problem? Like, how much is it that the people who are out front now don't exhibit the kind of ability to feel authentic to people? especially on issues that are important to them? And how much is it that they think the Democratic brand itself, the Democratic Party itself, is out of touch?
So I'm going to add to that. I think we've got a messenger problem. I think we have a message problem. I think we have an ideas problem. And I think we have a brand problem. So, and yeah. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. No, but a lot of those things are interrelated. Like, right, the brand problem is a result of the fact that our messengers are flawed, the message is flawed, the issues are flawed. When I say that we have an issues problem, I mean that, like, we literally, I can't remember the last time Democrats were putting forward big issues. And to the extent that you've seen big issues,
Big ideas.
We have an ideas problem. To the extent we've seen it, it's come in the form of like the Green New Deal or Medicare for All, which would force everyone off their healthcare plans and onto one size fits all government program, which, you know, just non-starters with the majority of the American people. So we've got to get back into the ideas business and having big ideas. And for all the talk of Trump just being this master salesman, I mean, the guy did run on ideas, build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. No taxes on tips. You asked Democrats, what was Kamala Harris's big idea? No one can answer that. What was their message? No one can answer that. So, one of the things that we saw with Zoran Mamdani here in New York was he was able to take off because he had very mimetic, easy to understand ideas, you know, freeze the rent, free buses. And, you know, he was able to communicate them in a very easy to understand way in mediums that people actually still consume. And so I think we need Democrats who understand that we need to run on issues. We need to have an easy to understand message that connects with people's day-to-day lives, right? When, like, you had Andrew Cuomo out there, you know, just yelling about Donald Trump and Zoran Mamdani talking about cost of living, Zoran was able to connect a lot more with people. So we need better messengers, better messages, better ideas, and then I think we can fix the brand.
The one thing, sorry, I'm jumping around a bit, but it when you raise the issue of all of those challenges, I'm also thinking to the midterms for a second. And as you know, there are many folks within the Democratic establishment who will say, okay, you're right, we have some of these problems, totally agree. But we need to make it through these midterms. And the best, strongest candidates are the ones with a track record, the ones who people know. So we need Janet Mills, who's the governor of Maine, because she has a track record. People know who she is. She's a safer bet than taking a risk with somebody like Graham Platner. We don't know much about him. He has a great, he's doing great on the socials. But what if he turns out to be the Tea Party equivalent of, right, the people that we know who ran in 2010 or 2012. Or Mick Morrow, that's nice, but she's just a state senator. You know, she hasn't run in a congressional district like Haley Stevens, who knows how to win in a swing area in the state.
Mallory flipped a district. She won Mitt Romney's hometown.
Exactly. So what risk reward is there out there? I mean, because you've already have examples in North Carolina.
Yeah,
Roy Cooper. He's not exactly going to be a establishment breaker.
Light the world on fire.
Exactly. And he's not anti-establishment, right? But he's the best candidate for North Carolina. So is there a risk? I mean, maybe that's the better question, because I don't think Mick Morrow fits into this as neatly as some others. But is there a risk that the Democratic candidates that connect the most with primary voters don't connect with a general electorate?
Well, that's why we have primaries, though. And I think to your point about is Platner Tea Party, I don't work with Platner. I don't know much about him besides what I see online. But in a primary, you can hash some of this stuff out. And, you know, primary voters at the end of the day really do care about electability. And so I wouldn't discount that. And so if Janet Mills wants to run and the DSCC wants to back her, then she should run and the DSCC should back her. You know, and that comes with positives and negatives.
Yeah. Like, what's happening in Michigan? Cause it feels too like there's been a thumb on the scale for somebody who's a federal officer.
Oh, of
right?
course. Oh yeah. Right. There completely is. And that situation is so bizarre too, because there is no energy on the ground, right? For Haley Stevens, no matter who you talk to, around the state, all the energy on the ground is for Mallory McMorrow and Abdul Al-Sayed. I'm not just saying this because I'm biased. I'll shout out Abdul as well. But I think, you know, a lot of that is because she seems like she will be a very safe establishment vote. But like, if you are putting your thumb on the scale for someone who can't attract a crowd of more than two people, including a tracker, then like maybe you need to reorient your priorities. Because I think more important than getting someone who will just fall in line behind the establishment is getting a candidate who could win a general election and who can excite and turn out Democrats and independents and swing voters.
Okay, I'm gonna end this with asking you a question about your optimism, or maybe it's your pessimism, as we go forward into 2028. It feels like there are going to be 762 Democrats who are going to run. But are you hopeful as you look out into the cast of potentially all of these people that there's somebody in there who will be a strong candidate? And that the party itself will be in a better place by the time we hit 28.
Yeah, I am hopeful. I think that 2026 will be really interesting to see what works, what doesn't work, what type of candidates rise to the top. There were some interesting candidates, frankly, who came out of the 2024 election. Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan,
right.
Ruben Gallego, especially I think in Arizona, has got a very unique appeal. And I think we'll see similar results from 2026, where you'll see candidates doing things differently, trying new things, like, you know, a James Tallarico in Texas, a Mallory McMorrow in Michigan, Graham Platner in Maine. I don't know. We're sort of fixated on those three, so I'll just keep those. But then you'll also see, you know, like a Bob Brooks in Pennsylvania, a Jamie Ager in North Carolina, a Sarah Trone-Garriott in Iowa's 3rd District, right? All running with very different profiles, but very different profiles from what you typically see from Democrats, right? Bob Brooks is a firefighter. Jamie Ager is a farmer. Sarah Trone-Garriott is an ordained minister who has flipped, you know, every red district known to man in that state. But I generally like to look at those races, see what's playing, and then sort of see from there where it's going to go. But I do think now there really is an understanding that voters are sick of the status quo, and that if Democrats run on the status quo like we did in 2024, we're going to get our asses handed to us. And that's like a key lesson to me from the mayoral election in New York, is that voters said, we do not want what establishment Democrats are handing to us with Andrew Cuomo. We will take a risk on a 33-year-old Democratic socialist because that is preferable than the establishment slop that you're handing us. And so in 2028, I think whoever rises to the top is going to be someone who channels that anti-establishment feeling, offers a change perspective, much like Barack Obama did in 2008.
Ms. Smith, thank you for all of your insights. Really, really, really appreciate this and look forward to talking to you more as we move through the cycle.
Great. Thank you for having me, Amy.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.